What's up, everybody? It's Nick Sarnicoli here, Forged by Fire, episode 28. And we've got a fantastic guest for you today, all the way from Connecticut. Albert Shaknazarov is here, and we're going to get to your story in just a second. For those of you guys that are watching this for the first time, what's Forged by Fire? It's the journey of an entrepreneur, but it's not talking about all the fancy, bright, shiny lights and success. It's about talking about the pain, the stuff that sucks, the failures. And my quick journey, so you guys can understand how it all bridges together. I'm from Michigan originally, super blue collar, middle class upbringing. All four grandparents worked at the same factory. I wanted to be rich one day. I found entrepreneurship at 18. Made my first million at 25. Created a company called Visalis and the Body by Vi 90 Day Challenge. 19 countries, 2.2 billion in sales, 3.6 million customers. It was an unbelievable ride of success and failure, the highest highs and the lowest lows, and everything in between, which means I know what that fire looks like and how it can forge you into a success story. So we're going to jump over to our guest today. Great to have you here, brother. Good to see you again. It's only been since Friday since I saw you last down in Puerto Rico. Yeah. Tell everyone your let's come your two-minute version of your story, and then we're going to dive deep into your story.
Albert Shaknazarov, CEO and founder of Axelead, but my story starts 32 years ago. When I was born inside a refugee camp, 350 square foot room, two twin beds, public bathrooms, public showers, running from the soldiers. My dad had to flee the country due to political persecution. And, you know, that's where we lived most of my childhood. We got an opportunity to come to the United States of America due to the, you know, changes within the country. And we wrote 18 letters for 18 months asking to get a chance to come to the greatest country in the world. And finally, you know, we got an opportunity. So on Independence Day, we're flying out to New York, JFK. Wow. We came in and I saw my dad on the next day looking for work, you know, because he had to put food on the table. And, you know, due to not having a father who was there consistently, my older brother had to get a job. Everybody had to work to be able to just make meets end. I kind of turned into a bad environment. I started to fight for money. And, you know, got arrested, got sentenced to 9 months in juvenile hall, did not speak one lick of English, was completely lost, confused. Once I get out of the detention center, I promised myself that, you know, I'm not going to waste my dad's sacrifices.
Right.
That I'm going to get my life together. I'm going to do something great. I went to school, graduated, 2.4 GPA, not the greatest, you know, GPA there. But I graduated and I got a bunch of scholarships to go play soccer. And nice. At 17 years old, I saw my dad working literally two jobs, 80 hours a week. And I had to make a decision. Do I want my dad to continue to work the way he's working? He just had a third heart attack. Or do I go and make money and make something out of myself? So hard decision to make. Give up a small dream for a bigger dream. The reason why I say for a bigger dream, because my dream was to retire my dad. And I said no to myself. I said yes to the future. And went in and went to sales at 17 years old, suffered, struggled, seen a lot of bad leadership, seen a lot of just bad companies treating people horrible, learned from that, decided to open my own company, you know, went through a lot of shit, being in the mud, in the dirt, but somehow figuring it out, right? And that's what the show is about. It's about being forged by fire. And, you know, at 28, made my first million. At 30, made, you know, dozens of millions of dollars. Today, we're number one in the country, in our industry, in our sector. And my goal, my purpose here is to be able to inspire entrepreneurs to go out there after their dreams and goals.
Let's go.
So that's why I'm here.
Great story. So just in that 3-minute breakdown, there's probably about a dozen stories of fire that you talked about. And I think anyone that was listening heard 350 square foot room.
Yeah.
So take us back there. You were in a refugee camp with your family. Yeah. Was it political asylum? How does this work? Tell me.
Yeah, so basically, you know, there was two genocides, okay? One was in 1915 with Armenia and Turkey. So Turkey took over Armenia, you know, manslaughter, over 3 million people dead. And that's where my original family moved to Azerbaijan to find, you know, safe home. That's where my dad was actually born. That's where my mom was, you know, around. That's how they met. And then in 1991, while my mom was pregnant with me, the country of Azerbaijan decided to get rid of all the Armenians. and overnight became, you know, a massacre. So therefore, we woke up with, apparently this is the stories that my dad's telling me, they woke up to hearing people scream because people were being thrown out of the building. People were being, their heads were cut off. My older brother, who was five years old at that time, saw people getting their heads cut off. And at that point, because my dad was born in Azerbaijan, he spoke perfect language of people from Azerbaijan. And they were kind of pretending to be from Azerbaijan.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But they people knew that lived around the area that they were not from Azerbaijan. The origin was from Armenia. So my dad said, okay, we got to go. So literally slept in a car.
What year is this?
1991.
How the hell does this happen still in 1991? It's just... like there's no news of it. You can't hear of any of it anywhere. It's nowhere.
And I'm gonna share something because it's very important. This is the stories that I'm told by my grandparents, my parents, is that people would walk into the hospitals and they would see Armenian last name and they would take those babies and they would set them on fire because they said we're gonna kill all the mankind from Armenia because they just didn't want that existence. And to me, you know, I could have been one of those babies.
Oh, my God.
Right? And I was in the belly of my mother, and they had to pay people. They had to hide in the trunks. They had to get on the trains just to be able to get to Russia. Once they got to Russia, there was a refugee camp for that specific reason. They turned a motel into a refugee camp. Okay. And that's how the 350 square foot room became our home. That's why we had public
bathroom.
For four of us, yeah.
And you said shared restroom, shared everything.
Yeah, and you got people that are, you know, drug addicts. You got all kinds of people that made it out, right? That became part of this refugee camp. And I seen it all. I seen people, you know, being beat up. I seen soldiers, you know, abusing women. I seen all of that. And growing up in that thing, my dad was trying to protect us. He wasn't trying to tell me the truth. He wasn't trying to tell me what was going on. And that was the most admiring thing about my dad is that he, no matter how bad the situation was, he was leading with love. He was leading with, okay, I gotta protect my family. I saw soldiers beat up my dad, right? And I said, what happened? He said, I was wrong. I wasn't supposed to do that. Instead of saying what was truly going on, that he was actually being, you know, abused.
How many years were you, what, did you move locations around Russia? How many years?
So my dad, you know, worked day in, day out. I mean, I'm talking about construction, buying candies, reselling it, doing whatever he could just to get us out of the refugee camp. And it took us about 8 years to get out of the refugee camp. Yeah, it was insane. Most of my childhood was refugee camp. People grew up with toys. People grew up with, you know, TV, all these things. I grew up with playing with brown Play-Doh. Spoons and forks, that was my toys, right? Soccer ball outside, that's what I would do all day long. So today when I see these things, the kids grow up and they say, I want more toys, I want more that. You know, it's the gratitude that kept me going to understand, okay, we don't have all the luxuries, but one thing we did have was love.
You know, we never went this deep in your story. I didn't really put together that it was 8 years. Your first 8 years of your life were spent in, you know, in a refugee camp. And the fact that even as you talk about it with almost a sense of peace and gratitude, as opposed to, you know, pain or hatred is extremely rare. But I have to guess that's because that's how your dad led it.
Yeah, 100%. The thing is, it's also what happened after we got out of the refugee camp. Even though refugee camp conditions were bad, but we were in a way protected because all the people were together. So it was kind of a unity thing.
Okay, right? It was a community.
Community, unity, everybody was together looking out for each other. Once we got out of the refugee camp and found ourselves an apartment building, you know, it was a one bedroom apartment. So you have one bedroom, you have a kitchen and you have a living room. And for us, it was like, okay, we went from 350 square foot to maybe now 900 square foot, but it was three times bigger.
And your own bathroom.
And our own bathroom, our own shower, right? But that's where the racism started. That's where, you know, a lot of things started to change because a lot of people did get out of the refugee camp and people said, Armenians are no longer welcome here. Or anybody that's not blue-eyed, blonde hair is not welcome here. And there's a specific group, okay, that's called skinheads.
So I wouldn't be welcome there.
You wouldn't.
Yeah.
You wouldn't. You would be, and again, they wouldn't know, right? But they would assume that you're not one of them and they would jump you, beat you up. And that's to me was harder, because for me to be able to go to the store, Nick, I got to get 20 of my friends to be able to just go buy yogurt, bread, and cheese and milk. Why? Because if I went by myself, those guys would jump us. My dad was working, coming out of work.
What city, sorry, what city in Russia is this?
So it's in Moscow.
Is it Moscow?
This is the center of the Moscow, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's different parts, but it would be like 25 minutes away from the Red Square. Okay. That's where we got ourselves an apartment. But my dad was working late night, you know, comes out of the store, and he got three people sitting on his car. And my dad asked him to move. And then next thing you know, out of the three people, it comes up 14 people, and 14 people end up beating him up, breaking the right side of his face. And he had broken into 100 different pieces. You know, I saw my dad in the hospital with operation and everything. And my older brother was buried in the snow, multiple concussions. Our home was broken into. My dad's car was set on fire. And it's because simply we don't like how
this
you
is
look.
Insane.
It's insane. And I know a lot of people say, what do you know about racism? Right? A lot of times when I, nowadays I'm an American, sure, people talk about racism, and I put my two cents, like, what do you know? And I'm like, oh, you have no idea, right? But that was very hard.
I'm an expert on this
because in refugee camp, even though conditions were shitty, there was community. When we got out, the conditions was a little bit better, but we were alone and there was no protection. So seeing my family go through all these pains, all these sufferings, my dad was writing these letters to White House, documenting everything, begging for an opportunity just to get out of Russia. And they gave us an opportunity. They said, you have literally 2-3 weeks to make
it. On July 4th, that's the first time I heard that part, by the
way. Yeah, on July 4th, that's when we actually flew into JFK.
How symbolic is that?
It is.
So freaking cool.
We found our independence.
Yeah. How old were you at that point?
So I was 13 turning 14.
Okay, so you've been through now 14 years of hell.
Yeah.
And eight of it, so 8 and 6, almost split down the middle. Yeah. Half of it in the refugee camp, half of it in Moscow in your own apartment, but no protection, you're on your own. And what was the parts that you took from that 14 years that you know helped you to become who you are today? What's two or three of those?
Well, growing up, and I'm sure there's a lot of people that didn't come from, you know, this country, that came from another country. You know, seeing my dad work this hard, seeing my dad do what he was doing, I knew that I can't go ask my dad if I want a Coca-Cola, if I want a Pepsi, if I want anything. I couldn't ask my dad for money. I had to go earn it.
Yeah.
So here I am, 7 years old, 8 years old, walking into abandoned buildings, taking aluminum, taking copper, burning in a forest, stripping out of the rubber, right? Putting on fire, taking that metal, selling it just to get a few bucks so that way I can support myself.
How old are you when you're doing this?
7, 8 years old.
7, 8 years old?
Yeah, oh yeah.
So I just put a video up last week. It's went viral on Instagram. It's like every day it's jumping by like 10,000 views and it's at like 3,000 shares right now. And it's about not teaching your children that you don't need that, but you have to earn that.
Yeah.
It's all about teaching them how to earn it. And there's literally people on there like, this is terrible parenting. You're going to make them feel guilty, so that way when they don't earn something, it's going to be guilt. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about, right? Like, people are so, have life so good over here that they want to chime in. I can't even say to my kids, hey, how do you earn that piece of candy? You are like, I can't even ask my dad for this. I have to earn this.
Yeah, 100%. And the thing is, I would feel ashamed of asking, knowing how hard he worked, right? Like, do you really need a Pepsi? Do you really need those shoes? Do you really want to play soccer? If you want to get a ball, you have to buy it. And the thing is, this is where your resourcefulness comes in.
Yeah.
Right? Being independent comes in. I would walk in and say, okay, these people in their backyard, they have carrots, they have beets. I'm going to take that. And now I'm gonna go sell it, right? And this is what I'm doing at 7, 8, 9 years old, just to be able to get some money into my pocket. That to me, the hard work, the work ethic, right? It's being able to understand that it's a good thing.
Yep.
People are afraid of work. People are saying, oh man, you shouldn't work hard.
Especially your generation.
Right, it's insane, right? And to me, it's like, no, you need to work hard because you feel so good about being able to get something, right? Produce something, win, and say, I have earned that.
Yes.
There's nothing great about being given something, right? Maybe for a moment, okay, because you wanted it, but then what? You didn't learn anything. You didn't become better. There's no lesson in that.
That I love hearing your story, man.
Thank you, brother.
So let's jump to America.
Yes.
So you're 14. Let's take the journey from 14 to say 20.
Yeah.
You came to the States.
Yeah.
How much English did you speak?
None. I mean, here's the thing. I knew how do you do, which was British, not even American.
So como estás?
Como estás, yeah. Yeah, and I knew color red because we were told you need to know red for danger, and that's it.
Green means go?
No, not even that, just money. Red. Yeah, nothing, you know. That was my English. That was very terrible for me. And one of the biggest thing is when I came to high school, everyone looked at me like I was an alien. I wore sweatpants with Skechers, you know.
I remember Skechers.
Yeah, I had a polo
those
on.
Those might be in now, by the way.
Yeah, okay. But I was made fun of. I was, you know, just an oddball. The worst thing why I decided with my wife to actually teach our kids at home, like do homeschooling, is because I remember how disconnected school was. And to me, I would come into class and they would know that I didn't speak English. They would know that, hey, this guy is a brand new kid that just came in here. And I would have a teacher pick on me and say, give me the answer. And I'm in front of 40 people in the classroom. Yeah. I would stand up. I know the math answer. I can do the multiplication. I can do the math equation. But I didn't know how to communicate it. And next thing you know, you're standing in front of, there's a cute girl looking at you.
Yeah.
Everybody's laughing. And now you're the
clown. Went there, grabbed the chalk and wrote it.
Yeah, no. And the thing is, you're so, you don't know the culture. You're sure, like, you sure. Can't come up to the thing.
Of course.
You don't know nothing. And I would hate, Nick, when I'm telling you, I hated going to high school more than living in a refugee camp.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's saying a lot.
It was a disaster. It was like, it was so dreading.
That's the the clip that's going to be like cut out. It's like, yeah. You know, I hated American high school more than a refugee camp in Russia.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
The amount of bullying, the amount of just negativity that I had to face every morning, and not just by students, but teachers, just environment. It was just insane. If it wasn't for sports in high school, I would never, ever thought I would make it.
And that's where you gained everyone's respect, right? You just started kicking their ass in the field.
Yeah, well, I gained everybody's respect because they started to call me an animal. They call me Beast from the East because I couldn't communicate.
That actually is a compliment.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But then again, right, I don't know how to communicate. They're making fun of me. All I know is I fought my entire life.
Yeah.
So therefore, I'm going to respond with a punch. I'm going to respond with a fight. And in my country, when you fight, the teachers are like, okay, let it happen, then break it apart.
Yeah.
And here, the cops show up, you get arrested, you get suspended. What is a suspension? I don't know what suspension is. And I would go home and they said, hey, why aren't you in school today? My dad would ask me the question. I said, Dad, I know you don't have a lot of money. There was a big field trip, cost over $1,000. I said, I'm gonna stay home. Next thing you know, I would rush to erase the voicemail the school left that was suspended. So that way they won't know. But I could only get away that for so many months until I got expelled.
That's a lot of field trips.
Yeah. That's a lot of field trips. And I got expelled.
For fighting?
For fighting. 13 suspension on the 14th time I got expelled.
Well, you know, you made a name for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. As you're a fighter.
Yeah. And the thing is, people left me alone. So like to me, I hate bullying. But if somebody's bullying you, you got to stand up to the bully.
Yeah.
And I think that's how you earn the respect. That's how people stop messing with you.
So this is an interesting thought. How much of your reaction with fighting was anger from your childhood? Mm. Or how much of it was just frustration with high school assholes?
Yeah, so I think it was just an automatic response. You know, our entire lives, we would fight. My brother would fight. You know, my brother is 5 years older than me, and he would fight on the street. With guys.
He did not look 5 years old.
Yeah, he did not, right? Everybody thinks I'm the older brother. And the crazy part, he would fight, you know, 14-year-olds, and he's 14, he's fighting a 14-year-old, and they got guys jumping in. Here I am, you know, 9 years old, jumping into a fight to fight a 14-year-old because I had loyalty towards my brother. It wasn't a fear of, oh, no, what if I get beat up? I'd rather get beat up than stand in the sidelines and do nothing. So to me, it was the automatic response. Something happens, you got to be able to fight. You got to be able to, you know, stand up for yourself. So I didn't care about the assholes in high school, but I had to show them that I wasn't going to be pushed around.
So what becomes the line of demarcation where you go from getting in trouble to shit, I've got to do something major with my life?
When my dad came to the detention center.
Okay.
And it was one of those moments in your life that everything
How
changed.
Old are you?
16? I was 16.
You're a minor.
Yeah, 15.
Okay, 15.
15 going to 16. Yeah, and he showed up in the detention center visiting hours, and he sat there, and he didn't cry. He wasn't happy. He wasn't mad. It looked like he had no life in him at all, and he just looked at me straight in my eyes. Yeah, tired, exhaustion, right? Looked me straight in the eyes, and he said, "Man, I sacrificed everything to come to this country. I gave up my language, my culture, my friends, my family, everything for you to be able to have a better life, and this is where you are. I cannot be proud of you." And then he got up and he left. And I sat there, even though visitation hours were over, I sat there, I asked for a minute. I wanted to cry so bad. That night, when I went back to my room, the bunk rooms, whatever it is, I had the roommate.
Yeah.
I cried, but I cried to the point to where no one can hear me. My tears were dropping, but I knew that if I show weakness, then hey, they're gonna take advantage of that. And I promised myself, I said, you know what, I'm going to change. I have to change. You know, it's going to be hard. People are going to, they know how to trigger me, but I'm going to have to change. Yeah. And that was the turning point for me to say, okay, I need to find better, you know, environment. I need to find better resources to be able to just not be like everyone else.
I admire and love the relationship that you have with your dad.
Thank you.
And it was so awesome to get a chance to meet him this weekend.
I appreciate
it. Because every story you tell in every stage, room, Zoom, yeah, even in private, it all goes back to my dad, my dad, my dad. So when you have that moment, you said, all right, I'm gonna make a change. When do you actually shift towards entrepreneurship?
Yeah.
What's your father's reaction when that happens? And by the way, listening to your story, you've always been trained at least in sales,
yeah,
but a solopreneur, you were taking carrots and reselling those. At, you know?
Right. Yeah,
like, yeah. Like that's, you know, you were actually in at least solopreneur sales since you were six, it sounds,
yeah,
like. But it didn't sound like, well, your dad sounded like he used to do some sales as well, just like buy stuff, resell, yes, it, buy stuff. But he was more steady income, traditional environment.
That's right. Exactly. Multiple jobs, managing different restaurants. My dad has an amazing customer service. I mean, this guy,
yeah,
knows how to take care of people, you know, and that's where I learn. You know, if I'm in a room full of people, I will take care of people that, you know, I know, yeah, that are there. And I learned that from
him. I've experienced that with you.
Thank you.
Drinks just kept showing up.
Yeah. So to me, I learned that from my dad, and he was more of a traditional guy. I think he took so much risk in his life, Nick, that he started to be afraid to take more risks.
Right.
Because there was a certain age. Now I got three kids. You know, how many more times am I going to start over? So he became more afraid to take risks. And he became more of a, okay, how do I find a safe zone? How do I find stability? And I didn't like that. Because I admired the guy that was taking the risk. Because, yeah, that's what was building, yeah, me up. But he, you know, at 17 years old, you know, I get multiple scholarships to go to different colleges. New York, LA, Florida.
Super ironic, by the way.
Yeah, right. And the thing is,
that's the beauty of sports.
My GPA is not that good, but hey, my skill on the field were amazing.
Yeah.
Published in multiple newspapers. But I'm looking at it and say, okay, my dad just had a third heart attack before my graduation. And I said, okay, I need to be able to save him. He's been saving me this whole time. I need to save him. And I need to find a way to be able to provide value. My dad was making $35,000 a year. And it's crazy, I didn't think that was a lot of money, even though I didn't know anything about money. I was like, right, what is $35,000? And I said, how do I replace that? I just need to be able to find something. And everybody kept pointing at sales. Everybody said, okay, you could do sales. You listen, I know your English is not this, blah, 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 you have an accent. But if you can figure out, you can do very well. And I said, okay. And I came home and I said to my dad, I said, Dad, I'm gonna do sales. And I said, I could do very well. He goes, well, you could do also very bad. And I'm like, oh my God, this is, you know, the negativity.
The initial reaction of a you know, middle class or lower middle class response, just like my dad.
So he said, I want you to go to college. I want you to get a criminal justice degree. And I want you to be able to to be a police officer.
Of course.
Because of your background, you've been arrested, blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, I cannot do that. I said, I don't believe in that. I cannot do that. So I said, you know what? I'm going to make you happy. And in the beginning, it's all about making your parents happy. But in reality, I was destroying myself. I'm going to school. I'm going to see a professor. They're talking about things. And, you know, I can't relate. I'm just sitting in a class. I don't like it.
Yeah.
But I'm just doing it to make my dad happy. And I just saw the level of confidence I was losing. I saw how I was becoming very antisocial because I was just doing things that were not feeding my soul.
Do you remember the moment in college where you said, I can't do this anymore?
Yeah, I do. I do. Yeah, my wife, my today's wife, we were in the same class in public speaking.
Well, there was a good reason for you to go to college.
Oh, yes.
No.
Well, I didn't meet her there. Oh. I'll tell you that. I met her by looking for opportunities, and she came to one of the opportunities, and I met her there. But we ended up being in the same class. And the professor...
You're not supposed to hook up with those, the people in the audience, by the way.
No. It was the other way around.
You're in the audience?
Yeah, exactly. So I was sitting there, and he was clicking her pen. And it's actually the professor of the public speaking class told her, can you stop clicking the pen? And my wife she's Puerto Rican. She has slow temper. She's Latina.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and she goes, click. And the professor goes, if you do it one more time, I'm going to kick you out. And she goes, click. And then he goes, out of my class. and I was like,
oh my God,
that's my that's my girlfriend. I was like, you don't talk to her like that. I'm like, you woke up on the wrong side of the bed. And my English is terrible at that time still. Yeah. I'm like, I said something like along the lines, you woke up on the wrong foot of the bed. And then she's like, that's not how it goes. I'm like, it doesn't matter. It don't matter. That's what I meant. And then
you make like a tree and get out of here.
Exactly. I just, you know, went out with her and I said, I'm not coming back. She said, I'm not coming back. And we never came back.
Yeah.
Funny enough, I'm meeting that public speaking teacher next week.
Shut up.
For a drink. Yeah. So
this is awesome.
Yeah. And the thing is, I kind of feel like if he didn't do that, maybe I would have stayed in college.
For sure. How did that transpire? Did you reach out to him? He reached out to you?
So it's actually, we met in gas station in front of my building. So I was putting gas, he was putting gas, and we're just connecting.
Oh, that's supposed to happen.
Yeah. He's just such a different person out of class.
Yeah.
You know, he's very, he comes from a military background, right? He understands this.
Well, you guys are so different too. You were teenagers then.
Exactly.
I remember my done with college moments. This is back when there was pagers. Remember pagers? Okay. Mm-hmm. So I was already in direct sales networking and I was in macroeconomics or maybe microeconomics, I don't remember. And the teacher was talking about opportunity cost. And this is the only thing I remember from college.
Wow.
And opportunity cost is what you give up for what you gain, right? So he was talking in terms of you spend $5, what did you lose in exchange for that Panther coffee?
Yes.
You lost 5 Snicker bars, whatever. And I was getting phone calls, which is actually business calls, right? Like, mm-hmm. Oh, we can make money. So as this is going off and as I'm sitting in this class and he's teaching opportunity costs, I'm like, oh, I got it. The opportunity cost of me sitting here is all of these customers and potential business partners that I'm not getting back to. And I walked out. And that was when I knew. I came back to finish the year, but I walked out and started making the return phone calls. But that's when mentally I was done. Yeah. Once I learned opportunity costs. So
the worst thing is that I didn't get any support by going into the business for myself. I didn't get any love. I came home, my dad actually took all my clothes, everything, threw it outside. He said, I can't believe you're not gonna go to college. Here you're doing it again. You're not gonna make me proud. And it's that guilt, right? It's that guilt. You feel those rip shots. And I said, you know what, that's fine. He goes, well, where are you gonna live, right? Literally, this is my house. You live under my roof. And I said, that's okay. I took all my clothes. I had a Mitsubishi Eclipse that was not registered, didn't have insurance, but I had the car. And I said, okay, well, I'm gonna live in my car. I'm gonna shower in the gym. I'm gonna live in my car. I'm gonna stay with my best friends. I'm gonna do whatever it takes. And I did that for 2 weeks. And my dad didn't call me for 2 weeks. 2 weeks passes, he calls me, did you eat? I'm worried. I love you. Just come back home. Listen, maybe you don't want to do
this
it right.
This is because you wanted to do network marketing?
Yeah, exactly. That's how I got into network marketing.
Dude, our stories are so similar. Like I didn't, but the I came back from the presentation and I grabbed the handle to the door and I opened the door. And my dad, who's like laying on the couch, they're waiting up for me. It's midnight on when they're supposed to be getting up for, for work. And he yells, he goes, "Don't even think about it." Right. And I can't see him. He's down around the corner. I yell back, "Think about what? You don't even know what it is. I don't care what it is. You ain't doing it."
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, "I'll do whatever I want. I'm 18 now." Yeah. And his response was, "Not underneath this roof." Yeah, it's right. The same shit that your dad said to you.
100%.
Holy cow.
I was 17, but you know, to me, it was just like, I can't continue to do what you want me to do.
Yeah.
You don't feel what I feel. You don't know what I know. And I was doing that for my dad. Like I everything I did in the beginning of my career, I did it for my dad. And not getting his support hurt tremendously. However, I did not use my why to become my why not, right? And I said, you know what, you just don't know better. And I started to read books. I started to understand about programming. I can't change a man who's 50 years old.
It's a lot of references in that file.
Exactly, exactly. And I'm not going to put that energy out there to try to fight with him and change him. I said, I'm just going to ignore him. I'm just going to look at him, smile, hug him, kiss him, tell him what he wants to hear, and continue to do what I want to do.
Yeah.
And that was the best decision I made.
So you end up, let's jump into, I'm glad I heard that part of the story because that's a different part I haven't heard. You end up learning a lot, growing a lot, doing well, building a successful team in the network marketing space. But you also, parallel to that, end up starting a traditional business, which is the business you have today.
I did, yeah.
And that became as a byproduct of you being number one inside of a company.
Yes.
And tell the story of what happens.
Yeah, so you know, in network marketing, for me, I didn't have a network of friends, family, and all those things, right? So I was like, I don't know anybody here, so I just got to go cold market, right? So it was very difficult for me to start making money. It took me 6 years to become profitable at six figures. So in the beginning of my career, I had a full-time job, and that full-time job was in sales. And I was making dials, telecommunication, technology, providing services. And while doing that, I was also doing full-time network marketing. Yeah. So once I build a team, I end up selling my portion of my business to another team, to another leader, right? Took that money and I said, I'm going to open my own business. Why did I decide to open my own business? Is because the company I was working with, you know, it was a ground floor opportunity. I came in and knocked on the door. I said, hey, I'm looking for a sales job. They said, hire. I said, wow, that's that easy. Wow, cool. They gave me a script. They said, here's your computer, here's your desk, here you go. I walk around, it's like a movie. You got five guys sitting there. One guy's watching YouTube. One guy is literally watching some porn shit. I don't know what it was. It was crazy. I'm like, what is going on? This is crazy.
Great culture.
Yeah, there's no culture, no management, nothing.
Well, there's a culture. It's a bad one.
It's a bad, exactly. One guy's playing games. And I'm just like, what is going on here? And nobody is doing anything productive. So I said, okay, if this is real, I'm going to be the best person in here. And 3 months later, all of those
literally
guys,
just recreated the scene of Wolf of Wall Street.
Right,
walks in.
Right, right. It's very similar to that. And I come in and 3 months later, all of those guys quit. And I'm by myself. I become somebody who understands sales, understands telecommunications. And I start to write scripts. Right, their script was this big. I start to write big scripts. Yeah. I write to have a sales process, rebuttals, all these things. You know, how to process the order. I start to create a system and processes in place. I start to bring people, hire people. Mind you, I'm getting paid $9 an hour and $15 per commission.
Okay.
Okay, not a lot of money. So next thing you know, I'm building a whole organization.
Is this on cell phone activation?
Cell phone activation.
So they're making $200 per activation. You're making $15.
Exactly, exactly. And I'm like, this just doesn't make any sense. But I said, you know what? What else am I going to do? Continue to do this because you're good here. So I build a company of 40 people. We start to do.
You're not a sales manager.
Yeah, I'm a sales manager. I promote myself basically. You know, still getting paid $9 an hour. But finally, they say, you know what? You've been doing a good job. We're going to give you $2 for every sale that somebody makes here. I said, cool. We were doing 1,000 activations per, we're doing 1,000 activations per month.
Nice.
Right? So we're becoming number one in that sector with the channel of AT&T. And I'm just like, okay, well, for some reason, I'm looking at my payroll and I did not get paid my bonus. So I knocked, I said, hey, I'm sorry, I didn't get paid my bonus. Wanted to know, you know, what happened because last month I didn't get paid either. And it's because they were so busy. It wasn't that they were bad people. They were just so busy that they were not paying attention to those things. That business was taken care of by me.
Right.
And I think they were having a bad day, or, you know, this person was having a bad day. And she said to me, "You should be thankful." And I said, "What do you mean?" "When you came here, you know, you didn't know anything about sales. You didn't have a college degree. And we gave you this opportunity. We basically made you who you are, right? And you need to appreciate that." And I said, "Wow, I already knew the numbers, what we were doing. We're doing like millions of dollars in sales." And I said, I'm going home with like $50,000, $60,000, you know, pay at the end of the year. And here I am making all this money for this company. I build this, I train people. And even I'm making at that point $13 an hour, Nick. I'm taking my own money and buying pizza for the room. I'm taking my own money and taking guys rock climbing because I wanted to build culture."
Yeah.
And like, it felt like somebody took ice cold water and just dumped it on me. I went home, I didn't sleep that night. The following morning, I put my 2 weeks notice and I left and I said, "I'm gonna open my own company." Funny enough, 6 months later, 6 to 9 months later, that whole business went out of business.
Of course.
Because there was no culture, there was no system, there was no process.
That's leadership.
Yeah.
If you're walking and nobody's behind you, you know, if you think you're leading and nobody's behind you, you're only taking a walk, right?
Exactly.
So they thought they were the influence. They thought they were the leader. They turned around, nobody was behind them because you were the leader.
Right, right. And I became a solopreneur, did big deals, made a lot of money. And I said, "Wow, now that I made a lot of money, now that, you know, I have things that I can do, I want to open a company and I want to inspire, I want to impact, and I want to lead people." And I started a company in the attic in the worst part of Hartford, Connecticut, Park Street. Some days we had no heat, some days we had no AC, sharing chicken nuggets. You know, I started with four guys. Two of them are still with me.
What year?
2015.
Okay, so you're coming a decade now.
Yeah. Yeah. So started there and gradually started to move. We went from an attic to a small 3,000 square foot office, from that to 6,000. And today we're in the center of Wethersfield, Connecticut, 10 minutes away from the Capitol, 16,000 square foot building, state of the art, everything custom made.
How many guys?
We have over 100 people now.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I know this as a reference, but you're the number one company at what you do in your sector. The number two company just got acquired.
You did.
What did they just get acquired for?
110.
So you got a $100 million company at least if you were to be acquired right now or more.
Yeah.
How's that feel?
It feels great. But knowing what we're doing right now and the amount of people that need our help, I don't feel accomplished.
Yep.
You know, the sales are great. The brand and marketing is great. We're throwing a lot of, you know, bonuses. But until we got 1,000 people making $100,000, I will not smile. You know what I mean?
And go deeper on that, because I've met a lot of your crew and they're just diehard loyal to you. You've created such a phenomenal culture. You want to help 1,000 folks make a six-figure income through the vehicles you're creating. But a lot of them have some similar characteristics. Go deeper.
Yeah, so, you know,
what's your real passion?
My real passion is taking people that are average or have an average mindset, living an average life, have average beliefs, and making them elite. Because no one did that for me, right? Everywhere I went and asked for help, people told me, "I'm not telling you anything because you're going to become my competition." And I do a lot of trainings for free for my guys. I go in and I do a lot of stuff for them that's going to help them financially, mentally, emotionally. I give them, you know, counsel to make their life better. And to me, is I see myself in them.
Yeah.
And I just know how badly I needed Nick Sarnicola in my life, how badly I needed Albert in my life. And, you know, fortunately, I met you later on in my career. But at those points, how much, like driving in a car, parking and crying because you don't know what to do, being frustrated, being behind the bills because you just don't know when to take a left and when to take a right, is very difficult. And I don't want my people to feel that way. I want my people to know that they can always call upon me. And I, you know, the other day I had somebody call me at 2:30 in the morning because they said, "Al, honestly, it's Wednesday. I just broke up with my girlfriend. I was drinking. And I remember what you told me on Friday, don't drink and drive. And I wanted to call you and I wanted to let you know that, you know, I'm not going to drive." I said, "Stay there. I'm going to order you an Uber." Order the guy the Uber. He went home. Knowing that there's people that can count on me,
yeah,
that gives me a sense of just confidence that there's people that need me, and I'm going to become that hero for them.
And I admire that about you, because it's who you are behind off camera, behind closed doors, and your team just absolutely is just loyal to the death for you. And you can't buy that, right? It's like, that's as authentic as it gets. So on this journey, it sounds like your Forged by Fire moment, you know, kind of leveraging the actual podcast brand here, is when you were sitting in that detention center. It sounds like this whole story, and it's good because I learned that about you today, is when your dad walked in, that was the moment where you're like, all right, I either change everything about myself right now or it's over.
Right.
And that's where that sword was forged,
That was 100%. Because here's the thing, you just know the amount of pain my dad went through.
Yeah.
And all I wanted to do was give him love. And I knew that if I would continue to go down the same path, I'm going to continue to give him pain. So it had to be a change to turn into love.
Well, you accomplished that. I'm going to take the conversation off topic for a second, because I think it's so critical. Okay. One of the things that we've talked about in the past is the difference in the sense of purpose, work ethic, focus, and desire of somebody not from this country.
Yes.
Because of what they've experienced of the lack of not having, versus the folks that maybe have been here, you know, for multiple generations and are sitting here whining about what they don't have. Talk to me about the distinction that you see between someone that came here from another country at 14, doesn't speak the language, lived either in danger or in a refugee camp his whole life.
I think it comes down to truly a lack of purpose. You know, I think everybody that comes to this country, they have a goal, end goal in mind. They have a chip on their shoulder. They're like, wow, we're coming to the greatest country in the world, right? You don't see people jump the board to go to Mexico. People come from Mexico here. You don't see people go from America to Russia. You see people from Russia come to America. And we have this sense of just like, you won the lottery. This is your one shot, one opportunity, and you got to make the most out of it. And we don't take that for granted. We don't take that for granted. For us, it's just that, okay, don't fuck this up. Like, this is your moment. And I think a lot of times when people are born here, they forget how good they have it. And I think to educate themselves, to be able to find that purpose, they have to really tap into, okay, why am I so lazy? Why am I so laid back? Why am I so just relaxed? And people nowadays, because of social media, because of everything.
Interesting. So urgency. You also, it sounds like you're also throwing urgency.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Because here's the thing. You look at social media, you look at what's happening in today's world, right? It's a lot of brainwashing in a negative way. Depression, right? Drugs, weed. What, like I ask people, I said, why do you smoke weed? I smoke weed because I can't go to sleep. Why can't you go to sleep? Well, I don't know. Well, dude, you're not fucking working hard enough. That's why. Because when I go home, I put my head on a pillow, I'm out.
Bro, I slept 3 hours in that red eye last night.
Yeah, you know?
And I landed, I'm like, let's go.
And it's like, no, you're just not putting yourself through enough action. If you go all the way back to centuries, Spartans didn't talk about stress. They didn't talk about depression. They didn't talk about any of that. There was no prescription.
And their lives are in danger all the time.
Exactly.
I'm gonna lean on the social media one because... and this is just semantics, but a lot of people are like, well, you know, social media is feeding X, Y, and Z. Kind of. Mm-hmm. It's whatever you're looking for on social media, it's going to feed. Because I use social media to feed me, you know, completely other things. I look for people of intelligence and look for books and look for podcasts. So you get what you're looking for on social media. The algorithm is indifferent.
Right.
The algorithm's just like, all right, whatever you're looking for, we're going to give you that times 1,000. And we're going to fucking shock your RAS with 1,000 versions of what you're looking for right now, nonstop. And then you just build on that.
Yes.
So it's imagine instilling people a sense of dreaming, goals, purpose, inspiration, and then letting them use social media for that.
Well, and I want to piggyback off that because this is you brought an amazing point. The reason why those things show up on their algorithm is because they're looking for it.
So they're looking for it.
But the reason why they're looking for it is because that's their surroundings, that's their environment, that's what they do.
Yeah.
Right? They don't have people talking about, go read this book. They don't have people telling them, hey, have a vision board, write this goal down. Hey, go do commissions, go do sales. Yeah. No, they have people that are saying, go get a job, be comfortable, smoke weed, do drugs, sure. get prescribed some pills.
Pick a side in polarizing political environment. Yeah. Pick a side and just feed that side. Absolutely, right?
Yeah, to me, if you're going to pick a side that makes you uncomfortable, not comfortable.
To me, well, and when it comes to the political side, it's like there's pieces of all of it that you know we all should be listening to.
Yeah.
It's like,
yes.
But everything's so polarizing because of how social media algorithms work. So it's driving that divide so drastically. So it's like, you know, my newsfeed is personal growth, personal development, business information, business contact, and attractive women.
Yes.
That's what I was looking for.
So
it just feeds me that. So this is great. So let's close up with this. Your top three tips for anyone that's an existing entrepreneur, solopreneur, sales professional, top three tips for anybody out there. Let's go straight to camera, the one on the right there.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna adjust your microphone. What do they need to know if they're gonna make it?
So number one, don't lead by request, lead by example. And a lot of times we have an ego, we have a chip on our shoulders. When we open up a company, we have a title and we have a position and we wanna be able to show people how good we are or demand the respect from them. I think if you just make your life be who you need to be and you do things right and do the right things, people will follow you because you're leading by a good example, not because you need to be doing it because somebody told you to do it. And it goes both ways. If you're part of some company and you're a leader, don't do things because somebody's telling you to do it. Do it because you want to do it and because you truly believe in the culture and the core values. So lead by example, not by request.
Amen. That's one. Two.
Number two, I would say people over profits. For a very long time, you know, and I know this because building a business is extremely hard and you want to be able to make a lot of money, but your focus should not be money. Your focus should be building a strong foundation of people that's going to help you build a strong business, that's going to help you get more revenue, that's going to help you get the profits that you're looking for. So if you put people first and you make sure that people are eating, people are taken care of, people have what they need, you will get what you need.
Number three. Take us home.
Okay, don't quit. No matter how hard it is, no matter what you're going through, if you quit, you are actually showing the world how much you didn't want to make it. So to me, I was going through these hard times. I was in a lawsuit. You know, I was backstabbed. People were stealing from me. I had my friends that screwed me over. All those things, I had contracts pulled away from me. All those things could be big reasons why I should quit. But I knew how bad I wanted to make it. And I promised to myself and the universe that the only way I'm going to quit is if I die.
Yes. So pick me up. Throw me in the ground. Guys, episode 28, Albert Shaknazarov all the way from Connecticut. Brought the heat today. Phenomenal story of overcoming every adversity that you could ever imagine. What's our excuse? Every time I hear his story, what's our excuse? I still have a quote that Albert has that rings through all my salespeople's brain and mind every day, which is every night before you go to bed, this was asked of him by one of our salespeople. Albert, what do you tell yourself every night before you go to bed? He says, I ask myself, did I earn my pillow tonight? Did I earn my pillow tonight? What a great freaking quote. And I hope you guys have enjoyed it. Episode 28, Forged by Fire. Catch the next one. Thanks, Albert.
Thank you, brother.